in Luke. We saw in the three evangelists' accounts of the stilling of the storm that the central matter was the matter of faith, and that faith was a range of things. And who's got the better faith, or which is the better faith represented? We saw the bare minimal blurted out screaming cry for help as reported in Mark, and we have the more respectful, deferential putting their need to Jesus in Luke, and in Matthew it's in the form of a prayer. Matthew's would do best in church, I suppose. We readily identify, I suppose, with the Markan level of faith, but mayn't get bogged down at any particular way of faith, but always be growing to larger and larger. But if one says larger and larger faith, one is in danger of taking readings on oneself. Do I have a stronger faith today than I did yesterday? Is my faith larger today than yesterday? A very dangerous question. If one is looking for the answer to that question to oneself, faith minus Christ equals zero. And the measure of faith is the measure of the more or less of Christ. So that the faith question is not answered by looking at yourself, whether you've been able to womp up a bigger faith today than you had yesterday, but is Jesus more for you? And we saw that as the criterion of the way in which we read the Gospels. At the end of reading any section, we ask the question, is Jesus more? In what way has some new dimension, some larger meaning of him come home to me, flowed into me and into my life? And it is the more of Jesus that is always the more of faith. Faith may never be then a self-regarding thing. And the answer to the question, am I God's child, if answered affirmatively, and then how can you say that, to which you may reply, I have faith, or you may say, Jesus died for me and rose again. The latter answer is the indestructible one. The former answer is true if faith has no other content than Jesus himself. The moment you see faith as something that you can adduce the evidences of out of yourself, to that extent your faith is wobbly and is the less, because you are looking for the evidences, the grounds in yourself, which is where they aren't, and not to Jesus, which is where they alone are. That whole range of faith then that's in here, and we mayn't then be judging one another's faith. It's in for each of us the more of Jesus. And I mentioned Luther's preaching on this text. And there comes through a dimension of faith, where he says, we are in the same boat and danger as Jesus. If we go down, he goes down too. And you just have to put up with it. And he's got a poorer chance than we do, because we are awake and he is sleeping. That kind of impudent faith, which has that kind of confidence that we are bound up with Christ and that we can no more perish than he can perish. And that gives the bravado of that kind of heroic faith. It's almost as if there's a note of mockery of Jesus, as if it could be that we've got a better chance of surviving than he does. And the bedrock conviction in all of that, that we can no more be destroyed than he could be destroyed, for our lives are bound up with him. We are in the same boat and danger as he is. That is further extrapolation, perhaps, of the cushion that exercised us yesterday. In Matthew, the account is told toward what does it mean to be a disciple. A disciple is one who follows. A disciple is one whose faith is what it's all about, a faith that is called forth by Jesus, by the word of Jesus, the word that he speaks, the word that carries him, the receiving Jesus, that is faith. And to that faith, then, the miracle is added as an extra. Then the miracle comes just as a gift. It isn't something that has to be grabbed onto to make Jesus for sure. There is nothing that makes Jesus for sure other than Jesus himself. And that is the big point in the way Matthew tells the story. In Mark, you have that you are there in the midst of this that's going on, and you are drawn into identification with these disciples who are just scared of being drowned and cry out their need, and Jesus seems to be utterly useless. Fat lot of good he is, snoozing on his cushion. But there is the prayer that grabs hold of him, shakes him, and he's got to come through. There's that kind of a faith that is little more than a dread fear. Almost as if there's no more faith there than a wanting to have faith. Sort of the level of, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. Their cry there is fraught with dread, with doubt, with fear, but it is a cry which is directed to Jesus, and to that extent it is faith, and he responds to that faith too and delivers them. Our particular interest is in Luke. What is it that we come away from Luke's account of the stilling of the storm with? That is Luke 8:22-25. We notice that Luke shortens it and smooths it. The vivid crudities of Mark are gone. The strong didactic impulse in Matthew is not there. If you ask the question, why does Luke bother to tell us about the stilling of the storm?
The spirit, movement of the spirit in the wind. This is, you know, it's kind of an eisegesis maybe, but has it any validity that it was the storm, kind of a symbol of the Holy Spirit, which focused their attention on Jesus and thereby brought him to them in a very striking and dramatic way? So here we have the function of the Holy Spirit in engendering or reinforcing faith. Is that too much to read into that?
There's the question one has to ask is, a couple of times we have extrapolated from the text, and as one pulls out further and further, one always has to be aware of at what point do we come unstuck from the text and are just carrying on with our ideas rather than those that have been prompted by or which grow out of the text itself. What do you feel about, has he come unstuck from the text, or is he still pulling things, is he still in sort of living relationship pulling things out from the text?
Well, see, the Spirit is operating in any encounter with Jesus. So, I admit, this is eisegesis. However, it seems like a pretty neat point to...
Good, yes, right. That's right.
Recognize the movement of the Holy Spirit in any encounter with Jesus.
Good.
Important consideration. It's not here, but the wind and the storm, you know, the symbol of the Holy Spirit on Pentecost, kind of just suggested this to me.
Yes.
And the fact of the storm induced them to arouse the sleeping Jesus.
His problem is he's in the Air Force in the sea, and it's the Navy who really knows about storms.
You know more about the wind.
You know more about the wind. You know about the waves.
You know about the waves. We know about the wind.
And Jesus has the lot in hand. And that is the message of Luke. So between the both of you, we get the whole of Luke. And what he is bidding us, what he is concerned for us to get here. It's Jesus that's running the show, that is running the whole show. And the prior statement of that theme is where he, before the stilling of the storm, there's the one about the centurion. And you get that same sense of who's running the show. The centurion knows what it is to run his show. He says to a man, go, and he goes, and come, and he comes. Okay, Jesus, you say it, and it'll be done.
that dimension of the centurion's thought world is shaped by his military experience. There's the chain of command and the flow chart and all of that. And number one on the centurion's flow chart, he acknowledges to be Jesus in his term. Now, as you all whipped through Luke since we were together last time, what other things did you pick up which show that Luke is the most, that he acknowledges Jesus as Lord most comprehensively? Even if you didn't get past the first two chapters, you would have got one of the clearest indications of that.
In the first chapter, he says how he has studied all these matters carefully from the beginning, and I thought it good to write an orderly account for you so that you will know.
Yes. Now, let's keep that in mind. That's one of the important factors that we have to fit into the whole Lucan picture this morning. But what we're reaching for now is that Luke presents Jesus as the one who's involved in running the whole show. It isn't just some Messiah Jesus that's there for Jews. He is there for everybody. In Matthew, the genealogy is traced from Abraham, the father of Israel's line. In Luke, the genealogy is traced from Adam, all men are involved in what is born of Mary. And in Luke, Jesus is more born of Mary than in Matthew, where the nativity action is more carried by Joseph. Not the primary fact of the nativity action. Joseph had nothing to do with that. But he gets the message and takes them off to Egypt. And he was going to put her away and all of that. So that there was the shame of Mary touched there. And in Matthew, it's the wise men who come, having gone to Herod the king, thinking that would be the way by which they would come to know where the king was born. In Luke, it is some shepherds. Now, let's work that data. So that Jesus is involved in all the sons and daughters of Adam. He is one of that whole lot. In Matthew, he is presented as from Abraham, that whole lot. In Matthew, the life of Jesus is presented in the pattern of the history of Israel. He comes out of Egypt and he has his 40 in the wilderness and the pattern of the book of Matthew is a pentateuchal pattern with the five great discourses, the five great gatherings together of the teaching of Jesus. And the message of Matthew is that Jesus does an Israel, same Israel, but he bringing it to fulfillment. And he that is indicated also by his having a 12. 12 is the number of Israel. You recall that Luke is writing to Theophilus, a Gentile. And so in Luke, a lot of the particularities or peculiarities which mean a lot to Israelites are left out or not bothered about so much. And when he picks up, now when Luke picks up the account, he does it in his own special way at the beginning of chapter 3. Chapters 1 and 2 are Sondergut. You're really wound at the Bible class when you get back home if you tell them about Sondergut. The matter which is peculiar to Luke, Luke's Sondergut, is chapters 1 and 2. And when he's got that down, then he moves into the story of the ministry of Jesus, which is has its prelude in the ministry of John the Baptist. Notice, Luke 3 verse 1. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch in Galilee, and his brother Philip the tetrarch of the region of Iturea, and Trachonitis and Lysanias tetrarch of Abilene, in the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, the son of Zechariah, in the wilderness. That's where Mark begins the whole story, with the ministry of John. Skips all the what went before. You don't need to know about that. Mark implies, by not beginning with a nativity account. Mark says, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet, behold, I send my messenger. And then comes, plonk, John the Baptist. Thump, you're right into it. Luke does things in an orderly way. Things have a beginning. You just don't sort of lob people in. There's John doing his thing. But Luke gives you how it started, where it came from. And you have in Luke the account of the nativities of John the Baptist and of Jesus. So that he is doing what he promises to do in the prologue. Things have a beginning, a middle, and an end. There is an orderliness about Luke's account. And a good deal of our questioning is, what's the key to that order that he follows through? The prologue is vital evidence for the sort of gospel that Luke is. Just keep your finger in at Luke 3:1 and come to Luke 1:1. Now those first four verses are the most polished, superbly constructed
piece of writing in all of the Gospels. It's a great period that could only be written by a well-educated man. We saw that the Gospel had its primary addressee in Theophilus, an aristocratic sort of chap. That's the excellent Theophilus that comes up in this prologue. So here we have at the beginning of the Gospel the evidence that it is being written by a man of education, of literary sensitivity and competence. And all, as you run through these parallels, you will find that where Mark or Matthew have got it clumsy, Luke has got it neat and more carefully formulated.
What do we know about the training of a physician?
Well, we haven't got any
academic training.
Luke has. Well, could we just sort of put that on the list of things to come to? Sort of Luke the physician, and what's the evidence for that? Luke wouldn't want us to get out of order. Just let me whip through this 1-4. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. Ministers of the word. You don't bump into them in the Gospels, but they have their part to play somewhere in this history. It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some times past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the truth concerning the things of which you have been informed. There's an interesting distinction there between being informed about something and knowing the truth about something. The truth level is the faith level. The informational level is not what saves you, and the devils know that as well. So Luke sort of tells us in this beautifully constructed sentence what he is about and how he's done his homework and heard through all that he could hear through and studied the other accounts of the matter. And this is sort of an attempt to sort out those accounts that Luke may have been doing his study on. Then, immediately following at verse 5, the quality of the Greek slumps, and it's like somebody talking who's hardly got through grade school. A great simplicity of the language beginning in verse 5. After he's given the dates, then you get this account going on. And you can ask why, how is it that the man that can write such a beautiful period and, you know, got A in English composition, in Greek composition, then comes to write in this astonishing, so suddenly simple and unornate and
without too much thought of construction and style. And the suggestion is that at that point he takes out his notebook and records what he took down from the person who knew most about it, the accounts in 1 and 2. Now, that is nothing more than an absolutely enchanting suggestion that Luke sat down with Mary and said, how was it? He's just told us that he did that with the eyewitnesses. It is difficult to suppose that he wouldn't have done that with Mary. One also then notices that he does not impose his own literary skill on his sources, and that as it comes to him in these accounts, so he is willing to just let it be set down. And you come in the Gospel to things which aren't very Lucan in their way of being put. And there you may recognize Luke's respect before his sources. He lets them have their say in the way they have their say as they come to him. In the stilling of the storm, we saw how he tidied it up, shortened it, smoothed it. And gave the account in a way in which the disciples were more polite and deferential in the way they dealt with Jesus. So, remember Mary. If you want to have a Mary time, the gospel that you look toward is Luke. You noticed at the beginning there how he gives the dating of how at the time when John the Baptist came in. And then at the beginning of chapter 3, he gives this enormously circumstantial way of dating things. That introduction, by the way, was a conventional way for a historian to begin his account of something. The thing that Luke omits to do, according to that convention, is to say what a botch of it all the other chaps did who had previously attempted it. You know, the way you do when you write a PhD thesis, you state the problem, and then you say, oh, Pufendorf said this about it, but he went wrong at that point, and then Krappelstein took that view, and then, of course, he didn't take that evidence into account, and so on. It was the convention when a historian began writing to say what their subject was and how they were going to go about it, and then show how inadequate everybody else was who did it. Luke is too much of a gentleman, one might say a Christian, to do it that way. We have noted we'll come back to Luke the gentleman later on. We are with him now at the moment as a historian. He indicates that he's sort of doing a historian's job by the way he writes this prologue. And then he does the beginning thing, like a good historian ought to do, and then gets at the beginning of the major action, which is where Mark sort of lands us right into, and that's at the beginning of chapter 3. And what's the point of all of that? Why is it important to tell us that this was when Tiberius Caesar was emperor? The Roman Empire was the whole world for them, as they knew it. So you get the statement, the first the reference of the first statement is to the whole world, and then sort of in concentric circles coming closer in, you get sort of down from the emperor, the naming of all the rulers and so on, till you get right into the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. You are then located in Judea and right at the heart of things. Why doesn't he just say, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas? For whom would that have sufficed? The Jews for Matthew. But Luke does it the other way. Why?
Right.
It's the same point as the genealogy coming from Adam. So it's the whole world, and this is the way you date history. And so what is happening here, what he is going to be telling us about, is something that is in the whole net of human history. Something is happening here which is tied in, involved with all of our human world, its story and its history. If you want to know if you want to make sense of the history of the world, Luke is implicitly saying, then pay attention to what I'm telling you. What's at the heart of it all is what's happened, is in this action that he is beginning to introduce. There is a world sweep, a historical dimension, involvedness, and focal pointedness about what Luke is setting about to tell us. If you want to know, Luke is the one who has thought the thing through in the historical dimension and says, if you want to get the hang of all of that, it's this son of Mary whose coming is proclaimed by John and whom we then follow to the cross. That's the key to it all, the focus of the lot. That also gives another dimension, that not only that Luke is at pains to show us that history carrying all the way through, and so there is in Luke an eschatological concern, that is, the coming of God's purposes to their final fulfillment. There is also an ecclesiastical dimension to the Lucan account, because Jesus isn't just a kind of pyrotechnic that bursts, but with him there is an input into the human story that goes on humanly into the lives of those who are his, the church, and its carrying on that history. And so he is not content to write part one only, but writes also part two, how all of Jesus makes its way then out into the world, on into the world, right to the center of the world. And when it gets to Rome, then it's at the world center and the world dimensionedness of the gospel of Jesus Christ is the message that Luke is carrying through. And that, you see, to this aristocratic Theophilus would be something that would engage his thinking. For in the Roman world at that time, things were pretty much falling apart one way and another, and only got worse and worse. And a citizen of that world would wonder, what's the sense of it all? And particularly if one bore responsibility as one of the upper crust in that world. And Luke tells Theophilus what it's really all about is what you'll come to know as you come to know this Jesus. And there is a profound apologetic wisdom in that way of putting it to Theophilus, and then showing that once you come to know this Jesus, you realize that all of the way that world has of going on, the glories of Rome and wealth and power, is backwards of the way it is with Jesus. One of the big messages of Luke is the reversal, the turning upside down of the values of the world and all its might and wealth and glory. And what evidence would you adduce to that point or against that point? Already this morning, there's the Mary that gives birth to her child in a stable. Funny sort of key to history, turning up in a stable. And those who are sort of called to receive him for who he is are some no count, nobody bothering about them, bottom of the pile shepherds. They are the people who are called. There is a profound concern for the little people, the no count people, in the Gospel of Luke. And a warning against the fat cats. The way in which the values of this world can take hold of a man, enslave him and destroy him. If you want the resources to deal with somebody in that situation, you reach to the Gospel of Luke. It's he who most denounces mammon. All of the influences, the lusts for status, power, might, grandeur, the way the world counts them, engage Luke. And remember, in the Beatitudes, Matthew says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Luke says simply, blessed are the poor. The poor, the oppressed, the little people, the people whom nobody bothers about or thinks are worth anything. These are the ones that Luke particularly has a care to tell us about Jesus having a care for them. He is there for them. They matter. And his way then the opposite of the way the great world goes. And if you want to know what God is up to in this world, if this world has any sense or meaning, you won't read it off the Tiberius Caesars, but you'll get the clue to it with the shepherds in the stable. And who is it that's always getting frightfully oppressed? In our day, we hear no end of how frightfully oppressed they are. In contrast with our society, the society in which Luke's account takes place, the women didn't matter all that much. And particularly if you were a widow, you really didn't have much social place or standing. And it is the widow of Nain that we learn about only from Luke. Luke tells us about the widow of Nain. It is from Luke. That was last night at 7:11. At 7:37, we get another woman that we only know about because Luke tells us about her. That was the scene. That's the scene in the home of Simon the Pharisee. Simon the Pharisee. He's the fat cat. He's got it all. He's a warm man. Nobody would question that he was a pretty successful and worthy of respect kind of man. And in contrast with him, there is set this woman, whom Luke refers to rather gently as a woman of the city, a sort of gentle euphemism for the sort of woman she was. You see a gentleness there. We spoke earlier of Luke the gentleman. He has an eye for the ladies, as the other evangelists do not. Of all of them, Luke would be the first to get up and give his chair to a lady. Not only because he was brought up educated, polite, refined. It's not so much because he's a ladies' man, but because he's telling of a Jesus who cares about people whom nobody else cares much about. And right at the bottom, whom everybody's ready to spit on, is this one that he calls a woman of the city. Then it is from Luke that we have the great scene in the home of Mary and Martha, 10:38. And then in Luke 13:11, there's the woman with the bad back. She couldn't stand up straight. And in the healings, when people come to be healed, Luke gives a more exact definition of what's wrong with them from a medical point of view than the other evangelists do. And that has led to Luke's being regarded as a physician. That his being a physician would fit that evidence quite nicely. The trouble is, an English scholar by the name of Caird looked at all of these medical kind of terms that Luke uses, and then compares their usage in Luke with other writers of his time, such as historians, and who are not medical men, and find that they are there used about equally much and exactly. So it would be possible to explain the greater precision of the medical language on the basis of his better education. Although there it is also possible to see his being a physician as the way in which he would come to have that kind of interest in putting it down the more exactly than the others do. Now, are there any... We had a few points dangling along the way. Are there any left, any unfinished business, or any particular item or question or contribution that you'd wish to make?
I thought it was peculiarly interesting, the three verses right before the session on the stilling the storm, the scene with the mother and the brothers who come to see him. Appears like some kind of almost like a commercial that pops across the scene. It's not a red herring, it sort of gives a direction.
Right, right. The drawing on what you said before, that we, when you look at a passage, you let it say just what it's saying, but a great help in that is to look at its immediate context. What's going on, what's the direction of thought, and there are echoes back and forth. Just as in the raising of the widow's son, in the following thing, there is the question of John the Baptist, is he the one who should come? And one of the things that is the answer to that question is, the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. It's those poor that engage Luke presents Jesus as being there for them. So that if you are asked to give the opening devotion at the Socialist Workers' Party, you would reach for Luke. If you are asked to give the opening devotion at a women's meeting, you're likely to find your best resources in Luke. If you are asked to give the opening devotion to a bunch of historians who are wrestling with the meaning of history, you would get your best resources from Luke. If you are dealing with somebody who figures they aren't worth anything at all, and you want to bring home to them that Jesus is there for them, you would have good resources in Luke. And there is that gentleness, that tenderness, that refined sensibility, not only in the way he can write, but also in the way of showing relationships between people, the emotional dimension. Mark is frightfully passionate, you know, and things are surging around all over the place. But in Luke, it's understated, but with an awareness of what's going on. In the phrase last night, where it said, and he gave him to his mother. You just stop and see all the world of what's going on with people there. The mother, the son, and Jesus giving the son to the mother. For that dimension, we are also particularly indebted to Luke.